Welcome to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. We've got a lot to get to today, so let's get to it. Up first, today on Rediscovered Radio, we return to early May 1971, when huge demonstrations were held in Washington, D.C. to protest the war in Vietnam. The organizers believed that more peaceful protest methods of the past weren't working. Theirs was a more radical agenda. For 3 days, protesters blocked intersections and bridges in D.C., intending to shut down the federal government. The Nixon administration reacted with force and on the third day brought in 10,000 federal troops. More than 12,000 demonstrators were eventually arrested. Amid the chaos in Washington, a new radio program went on the air. All things considered, NPR's flagship news program was born May 3, 1971. And among the stories of the day, listeners heard correspondent Jeff Kamen report on defiant young anti-war protesters and frustrated police officers.
Thousands of young people came to Washington willing to risk being arrested in order to end the war. They went into the streets this morning to stop the government from functioning by clogging many Washington roads during this morning's rush hour. For many demonstrators, the mobile street tactics of civil disobedience are an expected spring event. But before today, many other young people who came to Washington had not been willing to oppose the state with their bodies. For these young Americans, today was a major test of their commitment to the ethical code of the young and the angry. It was their freedom ride, their Selma march, their May Day.
All Things Considered was not heard on WYSO until 2 years later, but the WYSO staff and volunteers were busy collecting local stories during those uncertain days, and the WYSO archives is rich with that audio. Here's Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson.
2 weeks after the May Day protests in Washington, D.C., two young militants who had taken part in the demonstrations came to Antioch College to talk to students about revolution.
My name is Jennifer Dorn, and this is Johnny Lerner. Again, trying to figure out exactly what happened in Washington during the last 2 weeks and where we go from here. It's important to kind of put it into some kind of historical perspective if we can.
Jennifer Dorn was the sister of Bernadine Dorn, a leader of the Weather Underground who was on the FBI's most wanted list at the time. She had declared war on the U.S. government before going into hiding. Jennifer was a foot soldier in the group.
In our talking about what went down in Washington in the last couple of weeks, in the talking that we've done since the demonstrations were over, since we went into tactical retreat, as people talked about it, we've really been amazed, you know, to understand the myriad ways that people's strength and creativity came out in the situation.
Johnny Lerner had dropped out of Antioch College to work for a group called the Revolutionary Youth Movement, which eventually morphed into the Weather Underground. In the audio from the WYSO archives, Dorn and Lerner talk about the May Day protests, including placing a bomb in the U.S. Capitol building. Dr. Jonathan Winkler, chair of the History Department at Wright State University, listened to the recording.
This came immediately after a series of more peaceful efforts, including large numbers of veterans demonstrating against the war, and including the famous incident of lots of veterans depositing their medals on the Capitol steps. But the May Day protests that followed that, that the Weather Underground and many others were a part of here, was an attempt to shut down the federal government. And here they discuss how they sought to disrupt activities. They identify themselves more as organized opponents of the status quo of the very system that was in place. Rather than trying to come up with a peaceable solution or a peaceable change, they wanted to disrupt, to dismantle, to overthrow, for lack of a better word.
From our vantage point in the 21st century, recordings like this help us understand the complexity of the past. Dr. Winkler.
At one point, Lerner attributes the decline in the dollar in May of 1971 to the demonstrations in Washington, that they were succeeding when really it was the ongoing Bretton Woods crisis, the gold-dollar ratio problem, and what would eventually lead in August of 71 to the United States going off Bretton Woods and the gold standard. At one point, Dorn suggests that it might be useful to take LSD to help to put events of the last decade into perspective, and the audience just laughs. And she's puzzled. What's so funny? She later suggests that acid will be important in the coming of the revolution. So we very much get comments and thoughts and ideas that are of that time, that are not timeless, but reflect that world, such as it was. And it was a very different world, one that was as concerned with things about the way in which the world worked as we are concerned with them today. But these individuals here decided to take a very different path towards solution. And it's useful to listen to this to hear how earnestly they believe that their solution is the right solution, with all of the violence that that would have entailed.
It's as if Washington was really a very crude first battle of the People's Army of this country. You know, it was very crude and it was very haphazard in a lot of ways. But it's really, it's when you look at all the strong things that went on, that came out of people in that situation, you got a sense of where we have to move to build that army and build that struggle.
1971 seems like a long time ago now, and the young radicals are no longer young. Today, Jennifer Dorn is a professor of nursing at Columbia University, and Jonathan Lerner is a journalist and author. His memoir, Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary, will be released later this year. For Rediscovered Radio at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
You can hear more audio from the WYSO archives and link to the very first All Things Considered broadcast at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Picture it. Bell Fountain, Ohio, 1931. You've taken a seat inside the New Holland Theater. High upon the walls around you is a 17th century Dutch cityscape. Rows of nearly life-size houses, their window boxes filled with tulips that wave in the breeze. Several large, slowly turning windmills are also there. Above you, a bright blue sky, billowy clouds float by. In front of you, the largest movie screen in the state fills the stage, and as you're watching the popular films of the day, your brain registers that things are changing all around you. The daytime sky above falls into dusk and then into a nighttime sky filled with thousands of tiny shining stars. Candlelit windows on the Dutch houses give the impression of life inside. In the early days of moving pictures, plush movie houses sprang up around the country, but the Holland was unique for its Dutch-style theme. In fact, one of the houses included in the interior facade is a replica of the childhood home of its architect, Peter Hulsken, a Dutch immigrant who was living in Lima, Ohio. The music you hear is the opening score to the film Champagne Waltz. It played at the Holland Theater sometime around its 1937 release date. For decades, the theater flourished, but by 1998, dwindling audiences forced the Holland Theater to shut its doors. The same year the theater closed, Chris Swisher, now a retired elementary school teacher, was living and teaching in Bell Fountain. She and some of her sixth grade students were involved in an international competition called Future Problem Solving. The program is designed to develop the community problem-solving skills of young people all over the world. Swisher and her students decided that the shuttered Holland Theater was a problem for their community. So they chose it as their competition project, and, says Swisher, they also wanted to send a message to city officials.
Not to let this theater go. And so we started a public campaign. Kids marched in a parade. They wrote a play called As the Windmill Turns. We were able to perform it in the theater.
Swisher and her students took second place at the international level of the competition, and as a direct result of their efforts, a local advisory board was formed. The board's mission, save the theater.
Which was our goal, that citizens would pick it up as an interest. We knew that that wasn't where we were going to keep going, and that citizens would have to step up.
Step up they did. Soon after, the Logan County Landmark Preservation Board was formed. Swisher is the current board president, and in the last few years, they've worked to restore the theater to its original glory. Enter Chris Westhoff, the current managing director of the Holland Theater.
You know, the board is composed mostly of folks that grew up around here and work in business in Bell Fountain and really want to see it come to life in the way it was when they were children and what they remember. That's a lot of nostalgia.
Since those early days, the Holland has been through some remarkable changes. In the late 60s and early 70s, movie multiplexes were the new in thing. The historic Holland Theater became a five-cinema multiplex.
So you would watch a movie up there?
There had been a wall here.
Okay.
And there was a screen on the north half of it. And then there would have been a dividing wall down the middle of the balcony.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah. But it's pretty cool that it's coming back, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you wonder in a town with a population of 14,000 people how you support a theater. But we're trying to figure it out.
And the way Westhoff is figuring that out is by going beyond the brick-and-mortar renovations of the Holland. The walls separating each theater have been removed. The Dutch houses and atmospheric lighting are still operating. But Westhoff says modern-day success also has to come from updating the types of programming they offer.
It seems like people are more interested in having authentic experiences in smaller towns, and that small towns are becoming more popular as destinations. And we know when we have programs here on Friday or Saturday nights, all the restaurants and local businesses are doing better as well. So we're just trying to build the idea that Belle Fountain could be a destination.
It seems that audiences are responding to the expanded programming. More than 500 family and individual donors support the theater through annual gifts, and several large grants are funding continued repairs and renovations. To Westhoff, it signifies that the spirit of the Holland Theater will endure.
You know, there's an idea when you go to the theater that you enjoyed the show so much, you left the theater, you forgot you were even there. And I think that's built into the design of this room, to have a magical experience.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Susan Jennings has been the executive director of the Arthur Morgan Institute for Community Solutions since 2014. And today she joins us to provide updates on what's new with the organization. And we'll also talk about the upcoming Agraria Charrette, Saturday, May 20th. That's from 1 to 5 p.m. in Yellow Springs. Susan, welcome.
Thanks, Jerry. It's great to be here.
Susan, first, let's talk about the Institute. And I believe you've recently acquired some property. Let's talk about that and what your plans are for it.
Yes, we recently won at auction about 125 acres of a property that went up for auction in March. And we learned about the property from Tecumseh Land Trust and the village, who were hoping to preserve the property because it has Jacoby Creek traversing it. And the Jacoby is an important piece of the watershed for Xenia and for Yellow Springs, an important source of drinking water. So there was concern when the farm went up for auction that it may be developed, and our board and members encouraged us to bid on the property, and we just closed on it actually last Friday.
Okay, and so how do you plan to use this land in relation to your mission with Community Solutions?
Well, one of our most important focus areas over the last few years has been on soil health. And the reason for that is that soil has been seen as an important climate mitigation strategy. The development of carbon-rich soils actually could sequester a lot of the atmospheric carbon that's now contributing to climate change. So it has been an organizational priority, educating people about it, learning about it ourselves. And we had hoped to do some kind of a on-the-ground project to model some of the practices that build soil carbon. So when the farm came up for auction, it seemed somewhat obvious, but it was obviously a far larger project than we had anticipated. So it's a big organizational leap to actually be the owner of this farm.
And you mentioned the Jacoby Creek. There are some restoration plans
involved
with this, correct?
Yes, there are.
Tell us about that.
Sure. Tecumseh Land Trust has brought the Nature Conservancy on board, and the Nature Conservancy's planning to develop a restoration plan for the creek, which would involve the removal of honeysuckle and other invasives, allowing the stream to continue its natural meandering path, and then replanting the riparian barrier with native species.
All right. So let's talk about the conference coming up on May 20th.
So we're really excited about welcoming the Yellow Springs and other community members onto the property on May 20th. We feel that we would not have been able to complete the purchase without the generous support of the village, Tecumseh, as well as many, many community members. So this, in part, is a sort of welcome to the community event. But we're also really looking for people to bring their gardening and farming and soil and educational and community outreach experience to the Charrette. We're inviting people from Tecumseh and the Nature Conservancy, soil researchers, and expert farmers to kind of lead the charrette, and we'll be walking on the property, talking about some of the plans that we have, and then reconvening in our beautiful barn to brainstorm what might happen, what different ways that we can work with the community, with the schools, with Antioch, and with farmers to really make this a community resource that is used by many people.
And you're going to have a number of presenters on soil and stream restoration.
Yes, we are. Yes. So,
do you care to highlight a couple of those for us?
Sure. So we have Peter Bain, who's author of the Permaculture Act, Permaculture Handbook. He's going to be coming and talking about silvopasture and also agroforestry. We have Glenn Gall, who's going to be talking to us about rotational grazing. We have Eric Pulowski from OFA, who's going to come to talk to us about how our farm in particular and farms in general can transition to organics. And he's also going to be talking about biodynamics. And then we have Denny Eagleson, a local photographer, who's going to talk about the project that she has started, which is going to record the changes of the farm over time through photography.
Obviously, you've been collaborating with Tecumseh Land Trust and now the Nature Conservancy. Any other collaborations going on?
Yes. Antioch and specifically Professor Kim Landsbergen are working with us on the soil research plan. We've been working with Central State University on a plan to host interns on our farm next summer. And we've also been working with the Yellow Springs Schools on how to integrate the farm with their PBL classes.
So obviously Community Solutions believes that reaching out to young people and getting them involved is important.
Absolutely. I think soil has been an underreported and unappreciated resource, and I think many people are now beginning to understand how important it is to our health and to the climate, to water cycles. And students have been very excited, the students that we've been working with. For example, I just worked with Miss Morgan's third grade class at Mills Lawn School. We planted underpants throughout the Mills Lawn playground, and the idea is that when the underpants are dug up in about 5 weeks, that the amount of cotton that's left hanging to the elastic will show how robust the microbial activity is in the soil. So the kids, of course, had a great time planting underpants, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they find when they dig it up.
Oh, that's great. Maybe we can talk then as well.
Yeah.
Susan Jennings with the Arthur Morgan Institute for Community Solutions. The Agraria Charrette is Saturday, May 20th from 1 to 5 in Yellow Springs. And where can folks get more details?
They can
get
more information at our website, communitysolution.org, on our Facebook page, or by calling us at 767-2161.
Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jerry.
Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we'll hear from a student at Centerville High School who loves music and is wildly passionate about the bass guitar.
My name is Zach Whitaker. I'm a senior at Centerville High School. I'm a student, I'm an athlete, but most of all, I'm a bassist. I love the bass guitar. Music has always been a huge part of my life, particularly the bass. I found a love for music as a young kid. I would be sitting with my father in the basement, blasting the Beatles. Forget George and John's guitar, Ringo's drums, all I cared for was Paul on the bass. The simple bass line that is usually left behind hit me like a wall, almost like it was the only part of the song that I could hear. As I got older, I started to search for my own music. I tried listening to hip-hop, to rock, to country. I tried it all, but I just wasn't feeling it. I now realized that was because the bass wasn't there. That's why I turned to psychedelic rock. Those bass grooves turned me into a bass fiend. I found a particular band that has one of the best bassists in history. This band is the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and their bassist Flea. Listening to Flea's bass lines, Flea's funk, I fell in love. I couldn't get enough, and that's when it hit me. I was made to play. I was meant to pick up the bass. I was about 14, just getting into high school, finding out my real friends, and like most teens, finding out what stress was. The stress from school, my parents' high expectations to follow my sister, who's a straight-A student, getting her PhD from the University in Cincinnati. I'm a student athlete. I play football, which takes hours every day after school. I couldn't turn to my friends, because if you talked about your problems, you were a wuss. So now I needed a way to deal with stress. One night I was at my friend Brandon's house. Brandon is one of my closest friends, almost like a brother. I practically lived at his house. We were listening to the Red Hot Chili Peppers when I brought up my thoughts about playing the bass. His brother Alec overheard us. Alec is a very talented musician himself. He looked at me and said, "Why didn't you tell me this earlier?" He ran downstairs and came back with a huge acoustic bass and put it in my lap. I was frozen. Brandon said I was cheesing like a little kid opening presents on his birthday. Alec proceeded to tell me about frets, which strings was which. This was the first time I ever played the bass. Ever since that moment, I haven't put the bass down. I got my own acoustic Dean bass and practiced every day until the tips of my fingers would bleed. It wasn't enough. I wasn't happy with how terrible I sounded at first, not realizing that no one can pick up an instrument and be amazing right away. So I just kept practicing. Through my hard work, I began to grow, to improvise my own music. Today, after 4 years, I sit here with a newfound passion for music. I play my bass every single day, always turning to it when I need to relax, when I need to let go of my stress. If I could do one thing in life, it would be to influence everyone in the world to pick up an instrument. My bass is my sword, and together we'll slay the evils of stress and bring a new inspiration for music to the world. I am a bassist. For Dayton Youth Radio at Centerville High School, this is Zach Whitaker.
That was a story entitled "Stay Calm and Play Bass" by Centerville High School senior Zach Whitaker. Special thanks to Tricia Rapock, broadcasting teacher at Centerville. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Each year, Yellow Springs Schools host a winter and spring exhibition night at Mills Lawn and McKinney Middle School and Yellow Springs High School, where students from each grade, K through 12, make presentations on their recent projects to families and community members. The next exhibition nights will take place at McKinney Middle School and Yellow Springs High School on May 10th at 6 p.m. and Mills Lawn on May 16th at 5:30 p.m. To talk about the project-based learning approach used by these schools and how they help students and parents both, joining us in studio, we have the superintendent of Yellow Springs Schools, Mario Besora. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us about this year's exhibition night.
So exhibition night is a wonderful opportunity, I think, for the community to come out and see our kids showing their work and making it public. Because so often in schools, what happens is we do our work in isolation for a particular classroom and a teacher, and then we turn it in, and then a grade's given, and then nothing happens with the work. It just kind of goes away at that point. But what we want to do in Yellow Springs Schools through project-based learning is not just do work for doing work, but do work that has a greater purpose beyond the classroom and a life, usually around an authentic problem or need that the community has. And then we want to be able to make that work public in varying ways. And so one way we really think it's important for our students to make their work public is through exhibition nights. And it's a great opportunity for the entire Yellow Springs community to come out, and really anybody in the listening audience of WISO can come out to these exhibition nights. But it's a great opportunity to come out and hear about the work the kids are doing and see the difference between what Yellow Springs is doing in a project-based learning school and what you might see in a much more traditional school environment.
Can you highlight projects that folks might see this year?
Absolutely. So there are two projects I'd love to highlight for you. The first is a project called Flipping Stereotypes. And essentially, it is a high school AP art project where the kids decided that for their project, what they wanted to do was create a flip book. So it's very much a traditional flip book where you flip through and there's three different sort of indentations where you can flip and change it. And it's called Flipping Stereotypes because each page has a stereotype high school student. So you have the jock, you have the artist, you have the, you know, all the different stereotypes that could be out there for kids. and the band geek, I think, is one. And so there's all kinds of different stereotypes. And the idea is that as you flip through the book, the heads change or the bodies change, and it really changes how you look. And each time you change it, the words on the opposite page change and sort of give an interesting message about, you know, how our kids are different, how we're not all one stereotype, that we represent really a diverse set of, you know, characteristics, that everybody's different. And so I think our kids felt like, especially right now during this time in our country and in our history, they were inspired to really talk about stereotypes and express it. And this book is done in watercolor, so I'm going to brag about the kids for a second. Our arts programs are incredible in Yellow Springs schools, and this is one of the top projects I've ever seen. And to the point where they're going to actually get it published. Folks can purchase these online. They're going to be sold on Amazon. And I think it's going to be a great project for the kids, and it is top quality work. A second project, which is going on, a very cool project, and it's I'm going to have to say it right, because if I call it the Ugly Fruit Project, the kids will be upset with me. So this is going on, I believe, it is a third grade class, and it is a project about misshapen fruit. And so the kids were concerned about how fruit, essentially, how much produce gets thrown away. And what they've discovered was that there's a lot of produce that gets thrown away if it's the wrong shape, if it's not looking pretty in a way that needs to be looked pretty. And so the kids decided to do some research on this. And so they created their own gardens. They have planted their own seeds, and they've grown their own ugly vegetables, as they call them, or misshapen vegetables, they said. And their whole goal is to get out and promote misshapen vegetables in the greater community, to get more of an interest and more of a awareness of the issue of vegetables being thrown away if they're not exactly the right shape. And so they've done that, and it's a pretty amazing project, and they really invested from start to finish on this work, including creating their own misshapen vegetables themselves.
Our guest has been Superintendent of Yellow Springs Schools, Mario Basora. We've been talking about exhibition nights, which will take place at McKinney Middle School and Yellow Springs High School on May 10th at 6 p.m. and at Mills Lawn on May 16th. That one's at 5:30 p.m. Mario, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you, Jerry. It's been great to talk to you.
This weekend, around 900 participants, speakers, and volunteers from 42 states and 11 countries will visit the city of Dayton. They'll be in town for the International Trail Symposium. It's the largest gathering of trail professionals in the world. It's held in a different city every other year. And to talk about the Dayton event, we spoke with Brent Onslinger, the Outdoor Recreation Program Manager at Five Rivers Metro Parks.
We're really excited about the International Trail Symposium being in Dayton. It's kind of been a 9-year project from the time we started recruiting that to basically today when it opens up at the Dayton Convention Center. And so it's a thrill to have that in town and really to showcase to the world our own trail system and our own outdoor recreation kind of community to help celebrate and kind of host that event. There's 12 countries and 42 states represented in the attendees. And so it's really, truly an international audience coming to Dayton, and they'll be traveling throughout the region to experience our trails and our parks and natural assets.
Great. So let's talk about some of the activities there. There's going to be a climbing wall and a pump track. Explain.
Yeah, so basically on Sunday, so today at noon, things kick off for the public. So this is a professional conference where people are traveling in and spending some dollars to attend the professional part of the conference. But it also has some aspects that are available to the public for free. And so I definitely want to let people know about the free public day, which is from noon to 5 o'clock today, Sunday, May 7th. And so you can come down to the Dayton Convention Center. The expo will be open. There will be a pump track, which is kind of, imagine BMX or mountain bikes on that going around a loop course. And then there's also the rock wall. There'll be music going on. The exhibitors will be on full display. And then there's presentations that are available to the public. And really this year there's a theme with the National Trail System, because this symposium is kicking off a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System Act. And so we want to celebrate our national scenic trails and other national trails that we have, like our National Recreation Trail, the Great Miami River, and our Great Miami River Water Trail, which is a national water trail. Those are all being celebrated as a kickoff to that celebration as well. So come down to hear talks on the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, the North Country National Scenic Trail, which is our local national scenic trail. It runs from New York to North Dakota right through the Dayton area. And Yellow Springs. So there's talks on Brazilian trails and all kinds of different presentations as well. So we invite you down.
The International Trails Symposium, some public events starting today again at noon.
At noon, things start at the Dayton Convention Center, free and open to the public to come down and be part of the largest gathering of trail professionals in the world and see what's going on. And there's special things just for the public down there. One of those is at 5 o'clock today, a really special opportunity. A lot of people may have heard the name Grandma Gatewood, and she's famous within the Appalachian Trail hiking community, but she's from Ohio. She was the first person, the first female to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail solo, so to do the whole thing back in 1955 at age 67. Sorry. She's famous for wearing Keds and using a knapsack to cover that distance from Georgia to Maine. So she's from Ohio. She's a legend within the trails community. And so her connection to the National Trail System in Ohio, we wanted to bring her great-granddaughter in, who's going to introduce a film with director Peter Houston of a film called Trail Magic, The Grandma Gatewood Story. And it talks about her journey and what built up her notoriety. And so it's a really cool film. That's at 5 o'clock in the Dayton Convention Center Theater. It's free. We encourage you to attend. So that's a special kind of opportunity to kind of hear the Grandma Gatewood story and have that connection to the director and her great-granddaughter.
And tell us where people can find details on everything going on at Five
Rivers.
Well,
they can go to at Five Rivers Metroparks. You can go to metroparks.org. But for the Trail Symposium, you can go to americantrails.org/2017. And definitely a big thing to note is Monday night, Riverscape Metropark, 7 to 11 o'clock, is the Trails Rock Party. The Sly Band will be playing there. Craft beer will be sold benefiting Bike Miami Valley and the Buckeye Trail Association. And so that's a big party the public's invited to join the trail professionals. So at Riverscape Metropark, Monday, May 8th, 7 to 11 o'clock. And then Tuesday, to wrap things up as kind of a huge week in Dayton from an outdoor adventure standpoint, because we are the outdoor adventure capital of the Midwest. On Tuesday at 10:30 p.m. at Dayton Beer Company, they're having a contest to design the can for the Trailtown Pale Ale, a brand new beer that's actually available now. It started being served on Friday. And there's voting going on now through Tuesday evening to vote on the best can design for the Trailtown Pale Ale. So that kind of is culminating the week here of outdoor adventure that we have with the International Trail Symposium. So Dayton Beer Company is the place to be on Tuesday night.
Great. Brent Onslinger, Outdoor Recreation Program Manager with Five Rivers Metro Parks. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next week. Up next on WISO, Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.